Good morning and welcome to Behind the Headlines, the Friday morning news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. Heard around the state on Utah Public Radio, I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, Utah unemployment numbers soar while small businesses plead for more state help in the midst of a pandemic. Lawmakers meet in a largely digital special session, and official counts vastly underestimate the number of coronavirus cases. I have two guests joining me by phone today for this conversation, Salt Lake Tribune reporter Tony Semerad. Hi, Tony, and good morning to you.
Hey, Roger. How's it going?
Very good. Thanks for being here. Also on the phone with us is Salt Lake Tribune news columnist Robert Gerke. Good morning and welcome, Robert.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. And we will feature some other voices a little bit later in the show today as well. And maybe one of those voices will be yours. If you've got questions or comments about any of the stories that we are tackling today, call 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. You can also tweet to us. Our handle is at KCPW if you've got questions and comments about the stories that we will be talking about today. I think we should start with the special legislative session and what happened or what's happening, I guess, there. Robert Gerke, I know you were following along at home. I think very few people were actually on Capitol Hill for this special session. Can we actually start there? Who was at Utah's Capitol for this session? Anybody?
Yeah, so basically you had, the Speaker of the House, Brad Wilson, you had the Senate President, Stuart Adams. Each of them sort of took their traditional spot in their respective chambers on the dais, sort of presiding over the session. And then you had a handful of support staff, IT staff, and a couple select staffers. And then all of the legislators were working from home, kind of like Tony and I are today. They were dialed in by a video conference. It didn't go off seamlessly, but it went off pretty well. The Senate had a issue when they reconvened at 2 o'clock. With the whole Cisco system crashed, I guess, and so they kind of had to scramble to get it going. But they got it going, and they mowed through, a number of bills, most of them related to the pandemic in some way, shape, or form. Most of them were bills that were designed to limit the authority of local governments or limit the authority of the governor to respond to a pandemic, putting the legislature more into the mix, and adjusting state budgets. Obviously, with the economic impact of this, state revenues are going to be down, and they have to sort of move quickly to address some of those pressing budgetary issues.
Robert, Utah House Speaker Brad Wilson opened up the session by saying that he'd like to set a goal, or that he was trying to set a goal of reopening Utah, and he gave kind of a short timeline for doing that, the end of this month. Is that sort of aspirational goal? Is that a hard and fast date? I know there's a bill that's sort of around the, that's part of this as well. Maybe you can talk about that.
Well, yeah. So, we saw some pretty good coronavirus case numbers last week. They went up a little bit toward the end. Some of it looks like it was probably related to low level testing, but there's a lot of pressure on the governor and state leaders to get the economy moving again. Speaker Wilson said that he would like to, be moving in that direction, I think, by May 1st, have a plan in place. There was a bill that was sponsored by the Senate Majority Whip Dan Hemmert that would create a legislative commission, or I guess not all legislators, it's a commission, to formulate a plan and put in, a recommendation, or to make a recommendation to the governor on how to proceed with the reopening of government, sort of incremental steps that they can take to get to that, achieve that goal. And it is on a tight time frame. They're supposed to have the plan to the governor by April 22nd, I believe. And then he can act on the plan, he can adopt it, or he can write an explanation of why he thinks that it's premature. The hard part about this seems to be, though, that the legislature doesn't really have the expertise. It does direct the governor's office of management budget to appoint staff to support this legislative task force, this legislative commission. It would be appointed by, again, the speaker and the president, and made up of either legislators or, you know, other experts that they see fit to put on there. And then the governor would appoint four members as well. One of the components of this that is kind of interesting, I think, is that it also looks at this on a regional basis. I mean, it's not a one-size-fits-all thing, and I think that's something the governor's tried to avoid, is a one-size-fits-all thing. He's been pressured by people who are worried and think that, you know, Utah needs a statewide stay-at-home order. Utah's one of, I think, now it's seven states or maybe eight that doesn't have one in place. And so this would actually kind of go the other direction and look at how to open things up on a regional basis. You know, and if that happens, we've seen, places up in Cache County that are reopening gyms. We've seen places down south that are reopening restaurants on a limited basis that are moving in the direction of reopening restaurants. And we see the president directing or issuing these guidelines yesterday, sort of on a phased rolling reopening of the economy based on certain metrics in a given state. Obviously, ultimately, this ends up being up to the governor, though, to decide how we want to proceed.
The bill that creates this commission, it also would have potentially prohibited local governments from enacting stronger public health orders on their own, you know, stronger public health orders, that is, than the governor issues. That didn't stay in the bill. Where is this bill, by the way, Robert? Has it passed?
I believe that. So there were several moving pieces. The House convened, passed some bills in the morning. The Senate came back in the afternoon, and then the House is coming back today to pass the Senate bills. So the Senate passed this commission bill. The Senate passed a couple of the other bills, and then the House, the Senate, for example, last night passed the bill that both chambers have passed the bill you were discussing on the local on the consultation. The governor has to consult with legislative leaders on when he's issuing orders. There's sort of two pieces of this, of the legislature inserting itself into the pandemic response. One is it's sort of taking authority from the governor to unilaterally issue orders in an emergency situation, stay-at-home orders in particular. And they want the legislative leadership to receive those orders and be consulted 48 hours before the orders take effect, unless there's an imminent threat to the loss of life. And the concern that legislators have for their feeling is that the governor is acting unilaterally. This needs to be a team effort. Everybody needs to be on the same page. The governor's contention, he was asked about this the other day, it was that this is an executive authority. We've got to move fast in an emergency. And, we want to be team players, but we also have to, do the job of protecting the state. So there's a little bit of tension here. The other one that you asked about, that was a long way to get up to the question they actually asked. There's been some teeth gnashing, I think, about the Salt Lake County stay-at-home order, the Salt Lake City stay-at-home order. Most of the counties along the Wasatch Front right now have a stay-at-home order, except for Utah County. But the legislature doesn't necessarily like that either. Initially, the idea was that they were going to, supersede its local authorities and require it to be a state-level function. What they've come up with is the local, when there's a declared state of emergency by the governor, these local jurisdictions can issue their own, I think they call them restraint orders, if I remember, but basically a stay-at-home order. If they close businesses, if they're directing people to stay at home, if they're closing public places, public buildings, that sort of thing, then it has to be reviewed within 14 days by the local legislative body. So the city council or the county council or the county commission would have to review this in 14 days and either sign off on it or rescind it. It also gives some authority to the governor to either uh, he when there's a state order in place, he can veto these orders, or he can rewrite the orders essentially to avoid a conflict. So say, you know, say Salt Lake City has an order in place that conflicts with Salt Lake County, or Salt Lake County and Utah County have different orders in place. He can rewrite those orders to avoid a potential conflict.
You know, just going back to the beginning of where we started with the opening up of Utah, you know, at the beginning of May, which was sort of the goal set forth by in a kind of, maybe contingent way by House Speaker Brad Wilson. Is there a battle shaping up over how to handle this pandemic in the state of Utah, meaning opening the economy versus protecting public health? And is that really the choice before us, Robert Gerke? Maybe this is your news column, news columnist hat coming on.
Well, I mean, that's a really complicated question, I think. I think we talked about on here before, it's been 3 weeks ago, the governor issued his Utah Leads Together plan, which is his sort of model for his blueprint for reopening the economy. And it put certain metrics in place about the spread of the disease and about, you know, public health and safety. I mean, I think everybody would concur that public health and safety is and the data on the spread of the virus and the infections and the hospitalizations is what should drive this. You've got legislators, though, who I think are frustrated that both that they were not consulted, like we discussed, but also that they're hearing from their constituents that that it's time to go back to work. It's time, you know, we need to get the economy moving again, and so they're pushing, I think, in using the levers that they have at their disposal to push on the governor a little bit to try to expedite that.
Okay.
You know, the Angela Dunn, who's the state epidemiologist and is sort of the expert that people are looking to for guidance on this, said it's a great goal to have of starting to reopen by May 1. But it's also, as she said, needs to be driven by the data and by what we're seeing on the ground. And so, you know, she has pointed a few times to we need to see declines over a 2-week average, and we need to see additional testing. Both of those metrics were actually, interestingly, sort of the metrics that the President Trump pointed to when he issued his guidelines yesterday. So they're very much conducive in that regard, but we're not seeing that in the data yet.
Sure. So, I mean, you know, I guess, sorry, I don't mean to cut you off, Robert, but there's the you know, you can have a goal, but does the goal mean anything if the data is not doing what is necessary for, officials to take steps to make changes to the kinds of directives and public health orders that are out there? I guess is another question. Robert, we're going to have to run low on time here. And so I want to just sort of, is there any, you know, huge other, obviously there's some economic aspects of this legislative session that's happening right now. That are aimed to help people who are impacted, I think, which is everybody, by this pandemic in terms of the economy. Is there anything there? What have they done on that front?
Yeah. Well, so a couple of the other bills they did, they filled a gap in the unemployment insurance, and Tony could actually maybe talk about this a little bit better, but to expand that, to expand some workers' compensation for first responders who maybe get exposed to coronavirus. And then there was a bill as well to provide civil and criminal immunity to medical providers, which is a very broad category of people who are practicing medicine and may, you know, be sued for. And this bill has an interesting component to it. We've all heard about the debate about hydroxychloroquine, which is this malaria drug that the president's been touting. Some local leaders, including Senate President Stuart Adams, has been touting it. And there's the problem is that there's right now no evidence that it works, but they want to be able to prescribe these drugs like hydroxychloroquine and other experimental drugs to people as treatments for this disease, and they want to be immune from lawsuits if things go badly. And so that bill is passing as well.
And that's what this bill does. It says you have legal immunity if you are a physician who wants to prescribe an experimental drug You know, if this passes, you can do that.
Yeah.
And that's an interesting one. Maybe I'll go to Tony now, actually. Just Tony, on the economic front, I mean, we're talking about what, you know, some of the actions that are being taken at the state level. Help is obviously needed, and that's because we're seeing historic levels of unemployment filings in the state of Utah. Tony Semerad, what does that look like?
Well, yeah, that is our sort of leading indicator on the economic devastation from this over the last 4 or 5 weeks. We've been following weekly unemployment claims filed with Utah as people that have essentially been, you know, 90% of these, from what I understand, are people that have been furloughed. They've been temporarily sent home. But those claims have really shot up on a weekly basis. They appear to have sort of peaked 2 weeks prior, with about 30,000 people filing claims in the state, which was about, you know, five times the previous weekly record. I think our running total for people that have filed in Utah is something like 106,000 over the last 5 weeks, which, you know, the actual unemployment figure is sort of a lagging indicator. We won't get an official number for a while, but we're probably hovering in about the 6 to 10% unemployment level. Again, you know, these are most typically sort of temporary layoffs, furloughs, or people that are experiencing pay cuts, and there's this prospect that they'll go back. But I mean, that's just a piece of a much broader picture of about 22 million Americans having been thrown out of work in some capacity over the last 5 weeks.
Wow. You also wrote that thousands of business owners are asking for state officials to provide some assistance to them so that they can help both their, you know, their workers and their own businesses. What kind of pressure are they putting on the state legislature?
Well, I mean, just to back up, the federal stimulus provided something like $349 billion
right.
Nationally to small businesses and through forgivable loans, pretty advantageous kind of financing. Obviously, that money has been gobbled up. I think we had something like, last number I saw was like 12,900 applications out of Utah for a total of about $2.6 billion that we'll get. But, you know, small businesses are about 90% of employers in the state. You know, estimates are maybe 80,000 of them. A lot of them are struggling, and that money nationally is essentially gone.
Yeah.
And now that has put a lot of pressure on the debate in Congress for a reauthorization of what's called the Paycheck Protection Program, which was designed for these businesses to sort of hold on, keep people employed, you know, kind of on a temporary basis while these sort of public health measures play out.
Yeah. And that money the from the CARES Act that was part of the Paycheck Protection Program, as you said, is gone. Congress may reauthorize more funding for that, and that would offer more forgivable loans to small businesses in the United States that want to apply. That just depends on Congress, I guess.
Yeah, that's right. And on Utah's Capitol Hill, there's one bill Robert didn't mention, which essentially kind of sets state government up, or various agencies in state government, as a conduit for this federal stimulus money. There's a bill that will open up about $80 million to kind of be parsed out among, you know, to kind of help residents who might have trouble with housing through the Department of Workforce Services. And there's money for loans for farmers going through the Department of Agriculture. And then GoEd's being put in charge of a very interesting $40 million rental assistance grant program for commercial landlords, where small businesses have been hit by these public measures taken to contain the virus. So there's about $80 million on the table. The Senate is supposed to take that up in this special session this afternoon, at least give it a first debate, and then it'll go to the House. A lot of Utah small businesses either didn't get in time on the Paycheck Protection Program, or they, you know, because of some of the eligibility requirements, they just didn't qualify for the money. And even those that did face this sort of lag of, you know, maybe 2 or 3 weeks or so before the money starts flowing. They've been turning to a bunch of local bridge loan kind of programs, and There was $11 million out of GOED that was helping businesses at least get through these next couple of weeks before the federal money started to flow, and that's all gone now. So this money is drying up quickly, and I think, like I say, that's evidence of the devastation out there.
Yeah, and it seems obviously pretty significant. Tony, we need to head to a break here in the show, and I'm wondering, it's difficult. A lot of these businesses that have employees who are furloughed, or contract workers in particular who are trying to get unemployment, that's something that's available now, right? Like if you are a contract employer or employee, you can now get unemployment, whereas before you couldn't, correct?
Yeah, I mean, if you were self-employed or a so-called gig worker, an independent contractor, you were ineligible for state jobless benefits up until now. This is something that's been made available through, again, the Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security Act, this CARES Act. And the Department of Workforce Services, which administers unemployment insurance in Utah, I believe stepped that application process up this week. So for the first time ever, thanks to this federal largesse, that whole category of workers, probably thousands that have been thrown out of work in all of this, will be able to apply for these benefits for the first time. And if they do receive those, they'll also qualify for this $600 stipend that's being added nationally to unemployment benefits, which, you know, if you were maxed out on state jobless benefits, that essentially doubles your weekly check. That's a substantial addition to what you typically receive.
All right. That's Tony Semerad, a reporter with the Salt Lake Tribune. We need to head to our first break in the show. There's still more ahead on this edition of Behind the Headlines from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune, heard statewide on Utah Public Radio. We'll be back in just a minute.
UPR's Tom Williams, Wendy Hassan, Executive Director of Cash Arts, and Sarah Austin Jenis, Executive Producer for The Moth, have a special announcement for you.
I am delighted to announce that this October at the Cache Valley Center for the Arts at the Ellen Eccles Theater, we will be presenting The Moth.
So October 22nd, and this is a live main stage show.
Moth main stages are our unique storytelling nights where we have five storytellers who've worked and crafted their stories with a director ahead of time. And we always have some local voices, so we're excited to see who from Utah will be joining us on stage. The evenings are filled with humor and heart, and everyone leaves the night feeling a little bit more connected.
Yes, that's right. This October 22nd at the Ellen Eccles Theater in Logan, Utah, we will be presenting The Moth, and we are so excited.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I'm joined by Salt Lake Tribune reporter Tony Semerad and columnist Robert Gerke. This is our Friday morning news roundup, and you can join us with your questions and comments. The number is 801-355-8255. You can also tweet to at KCPW with your questions and comments. Well, we're going to put Tony and Robert into timeout here for a minute because we're going to now turn to a conversation with Salt Lake Tribune reporter Andy Larson, whose usual beat, the Utah Jazz, is kind of on hiatus. And so Andy has been joining in the coronavirus coverage, and he looked at some numbers on virus testing and case counts, both in Utah and around the world. Take a listen to our conversation. Andy Larson, thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You know, I was going to introduce you as a Utah Jazz beat reporter, but everything has changed. This week you did some digging on the coronavirus case count, both here in Utah and also around the world. One part of your story is that the case count is likely a gross underestimation. Is that right, Andy? And to what degree?
Yeah, I mean, we know how, with the testing issues, with how few people have gotten a test, with how many people have been turned away, and then this huge number of people that we're just finding out are nearly completely asymptomatic, that never think they needed a test. We're just undercounting how many people have been infected with the coronavirus by a huge degree. And trying to figure that out has been a real question of, we can use kind of these antibody tests to find out. We can use
Wait, hold on. I want to stop you there. What does that mean? An antibody test? Maybe you can give us the sort of lowdown on what
test does. Yeah. When someone's infected with the coronavirus, their body creates what are called antibodies, which is their immune system is fighting against the disease, right? And so that's basically these antibodies are used to protect the body from future infection. And you know, it's by that mechanism that people become immune to something after they've already gotten it once.
That was one of the tests that you were describing, or one of the ways that we could figure, I guess, maybe better understand how many people are infected. Can you go back to that, Andy? I'm sorry to have cut you off.
Yeah, no worries. The antibody tests basically allow us, it's a simple blood test. It takes about 15 to 45 minutes, and depending on the test, but it allows you to see whether or not someone has already had the coronavirus. We can also, if we do that on a large sample of the population, we can kind of figure out how many people have it. There are have been other populations, quite frankly, where we just did kind of the standard stick it up your nose or stick it through the back of your throat testing on a huge slice of a population, whether it be kind of a small town or recently a New York City hospital did it on every single pregnant woman who came in for a delivery. And so in that way, we can kind of figure out in these populations, how many of the people have been infected so far.
And it turns out, I mean, using the example of the pregnant women in the New York City hospital, there was a bigger percentage of that population, at least, than than the general population. And has that been the case with all of the antibody testing that's been done?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, clearly we're undercounting and clearly significantly undercounting. I mean, the New York mother case, about 1.2% of New York has gotten a positive test result so far. But out of the pregnant mothers who were tested, 15% of them tested positive, and only 4 of them were symptomatic, which is about 1-2%, and 29 of them were completely asymptomatic. They didn't think that they had the disease and were surprised to learn that they had tested positive. So that kind of gives you an idea. You know, obviously, most pregnant mothers are relatively young. You know, you're not running into a lot of plus 65 pregnant mothers. And so, you know, there are reasons to believe that they, you know, it's not necessarily representative of the population as a whole, but it does kind of reflect how many people may have been infected, especially in New York City, that haven't shown the symptoms and haven't been counted in the overall count.
I want to get to the Utah specific aspect of this story, just in terms of our numbers. I mean, there have been some estimates, right, Andy, in terms of how many degrees more of people are likely infected in Utah. I mean, if you look at a case count from a specific date in March, can you explain that?
Yeah, I mean, this was a early study that had been done as of March 15th. And basically what they did was nationwide look at how many people went to their doctors with influenza-like symptoms. So having a fever, having a cough, those kind of things. And they found at that point that, you know, if you look at the numbers of people who did that, went to their doctor for that, and subtract the number of positive flu tests that were taken, and then also subtract the number of people who usually get those symptoms for reasons other than the flu, you know, kind of what's the excess number of people who had these symptoms. They estimated that in Utah, about only 1 in 300 people had been counted as of March 15th. Now, look, on March 15th, we only thought that there were 20 positive tests. You know, there were 20 cases, right? So this was a different world back then, even as recently as March 15th was. But it gives us some idea of how, you know, miscalculated these numbers were early in the cycle rather than right now.
Yeah. You know, there's another part of that that's also kind of interesting. It's also a component of your reporting. You know, you synthesized a bunch of material. You looked at a lot of other academic and population metrics and other materials that are out there. And it turns out that because of all of this underreporting, the novel coronavirus is quite a bit more contagious than we had thought, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's if you look at kind of how these epidemiologists have been studying the curve, naturally, they've been going off of positive test results, right? And I think that's you kind of work backwards to get what they call R naught, which is the contagion rate, the number of people, you know, if I have the coronavirus, what's the number of people I spread it to on average is basically that number. And so if you add in all of these extra cases that are not being counted, you have to naturally adjust the R naught higher. The number of people I'm infecting goes up because it turns out that there are a lot of people that just, you know, aren't showing symptoms or don't get tested for it, right? So One CDC study that was released this week said that the R-naught in Wuhan was 5.7, which is significantly higher than what we thought in the past. You know, we were kind of working with a somewhere between 2 to 3 estimate. That's about what regular influenza is. And it seems like it's significantly more contagious than that right now.
Yeah, and it's interesting because every sort of degree up you go in that R-naught factor means a lot more infections. It's not like a one person more infection. It's for every person who has it, those numbers begin to, I mean, you get to an exponential growth trajectory that's different than it would have been if it was lower. I mean, obviously. Here's a question. I want to circle back actually to the idea of antibody testing. And you talked about antibodies being this you know, marker of the fact that we've had the virus, and then also a marker to some extent in a lot of viruses of immunity. Does that mean that, you know, if you get the antibody testing and you're shown to have had this virus, that you should be allowed back out in the world? Does that make sense? Can you even answer that, Andy?
It's a sign. It's a signal. At this point, we honestly don't know a lot about how the immunity to this thing works, is basically what it comes down to. I would say, first of all, those tests do have a rather large false positive rate. ARUP laboratories, for example, their false positive rate is 1.6, I believe, percent of tests are positive, even if someone does not have antibodies. And so, you know, if someone thinks they're positive and goes out in the world and then can catch it anyway, that's obviously a problem. It's also clear that there's a lot of variation in terms of how many antibodies you have and how many antibodies are tested and are caught by this test, versus the amount of viral load you can get out in the world. You know, it may be a case where, you know, going to a grocery store is different than being on the Diamond Princess cruise ship, you know, and the amount of viral load you get of the coronavirus is just different in different circumstances, and different amount of antibodies may fight against that on a different level. So, you know, I think it's one of those things that we're definitely still studying, and we don't really know what the complete immune picture is right now, even if someone does test positive for those antibodies.
You know, I also kind of neglected to jump further into the fact that if this is more contagious than we thought, that means that the death rate is actually quite a bit lower than we had been thinking, because if a lot more people have it and the same number of people are dying, then it's less deadly than we thought. Does that mean that we should go back out into the world, Andy? Are we ready to just say, all right, this is just like the flu and let's move on?
Yeah, I mean, it's tempting to, right? And you're right that you look at, if you have a larger denominator in terms of the number of people who get this, your death rate naturally goes down. And I think, you know, you look at estimates that say this thing is, I think there's a clear agreement that it is somewhat more deadly than the flu, but it may not be 100 or 200 times or 1,000 times more deadly than the flu. It may be, you know, 1 to 10 times more deadly than the flu, which, you know, is still bad, but it kind of gives you an idea that you may want to open up. But the problem is because it is so contagious that if you do open up businesses, if you do open up, you know, sports and theaters and those kind of things, that with the amount of people who do usually get it from any individual carrier, you just are asking for these kind of super spreader events that happened at the very beginning of this outbreak and really kind of cause it to explode again. And that's how we get things like, you know, second waves that then go on to kill a number of people anyway. So if anything, it's like a reason to be more careful.
Well, and that was one of the takeaways from the 1918 Spanish influenza, was that there were waves of it and it came back in waves and killed more people after its first wave than it did in that first initial wave. Anyway, I'll leave that to the side. Andy Larson, I guess another thing I'll ask, there are some people out there who are advocating for herd immunity. What is that? What does that mean, herd immunity?
The idea is there's a certain number of people that you can, that if everyone gets the disease, or nearly everyone gets the disease, at a certain point, those people are going to be immune and the virus can't spread anymore. You know, it just doesn't have as many hosts to infect. And it would work, right? I mean, the problem is that even with a low fatality rate, you know, even if it's a fatality rate exactly of influenza as we know it, that still means 200,000 to 1 million people die in the United States. And I think that's a death toll that we're probably not excited to have.
No, I don't think so. All right. Well, so you conclude in your article by saying that, you know, basically where that leaves us is that we need to develop a vaccine. And, you know, you've been looking at the reporting on this, Andy. Any time frame from what you've been looking at on when a vaccine might become available?
Look, I mean, the standard time frame on, not the standard, even kind of a rush time frame on this is 12 to 18 months to develop a vaccine from start to finish. And that's really kind of what we're working with, is because we only really discovered the coronavirus back in December, right? You know, this is a new thing that we didn't know about 5 months ago. So, you know, that's kind of the standard timeline, and that puts it in 2021 at some point. I do think that this is a special case. And, you know, you look at the number of billions of dollars that Bill Gates' foundation is throwing at it to develop 7 different vaccines in series, so that, you know, if any of them are ready to go, they're actually building these factories to, you know, make this right away rather than kind of having to waste time on production and those kind of things. I think there are reasons that, you know, people are willing to take tests for vaccines that in no other circumstance would they be willing to test themselves, because this is such a unique time. But, you know, I think we're going to get like human tests on these vaccines earlier in the process than we would in any other circumstance. So I'm relatively optimistic about a quicker vaccine than that. But honestly, if we want to be safe about it, 12 to 18 months is probably a reasonable guess.
And that's maybe what a bunch of us are gearing up for in terms of kind of living in a new world. I've got a final question for you, Andy, which is Rudy Gobert and Donovan Mitchell, they don't really hate each other, do they?
I don't know. It's what it comes down to. Rudy came out this weekend and said that they had talked on Saturday and tried to work it out, came to an agreement that, you know, the number one thing in their lives was basketball. But clearly, you know, they didn't talk for a month after this thing, and clearly there were hurt feelings. So, I, you know, where they stand right now is, I don't know. I don't think any of us know. I don't know that they know. But if there is a bright side to waiting for sports to resume, it's that they have plenty of time to figure it out.
Andy Larson is normally a Utah Jazz beat reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. He's covering all things coronavirus and more for the paper right now. Andy, thanks for taking the time today.
Yeah, thanks again for having me.
And thanks once more to Andy Larson for joining me via Zoom. I've still got reporter Tony Semerad and columnist Robert Gerke here on the phone with me. And before we move on, I got a question that I have to ask: is, do the two of you miss sports right now? I'm missing baseball on my part, but how about the two of you?
Well, Gerke's got it in spades with sports fandom. I am not a sports fan.
All right, Tony's fine. Tony gets a pass. Gerke?
I mean, I'm willing to bet on just about anything right now. I'm racing my vacuum cleaner, you know, the dogs are, you know, which dog is going to eat the most. I need the competition in my life. So, yeah, it's painful. And I think, you know, it's interesting that the whole notion of reopening sporting venues, because there are places where people pack in together and it's really difficult. It's one of the things that was highlighted again yesterday in the Trump deadlines. And you've also, I mean, you've got these sports leagues talking about reopening without fans. And
right.
I'm fascinated by that, you know. But right now, I guess we have the NBA horse competition.
Right.
The ESPN is showing them. Hanging on that rapt attention.
All right. Well, I'm going to remind listeners that you are tuned to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We are digging into the news you've been reading in the pages of the Salt Lake Tribune, and you can join us with your questions, comments, lamentations about sports, and other questions by calling 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255, or you can tweet to us. Our handle is at KCPW. Tony Semerad, Andy Larson was talking about case counts and testing and the hope for a vaccine in the future. But there is still, you know, a public health emergency going on. Some places have been hit harder than others. New York City, for example. And so some Utah doctors headed off there to New York City this week. And they're there to try and help, I guess. Can you tell us about this team of doctors and what they're doing?
Well, yeah, it's actually kind of a fascinating dynamic. There is, you know, apparently enough capacity in our medical system here, thanks to some of the efforts to kind of, you know, slow the curve or whatever, that Intermountain Healthcare is sending a couple of teams to affiliated hospitals in the New York City area, kind of basically in the Queens area. And these two teams of 50 medical caregivers from Utah, you know, a full range of, physicians, respiratory therapists, nurse practitioners, will kind of be deployed in the front lines. New York's obviously the epicenter right now. There's some very interesting kind of balancing issues there. Obviously, there'll be very welcome healthcare professionals in New York are stressed and overburdened right now. They'll certainly go to good use. There is this whole issue of whether they'll be exposed, whether we're boosting their exposure level, and there's a very careful kind of quarantine protocol or testing protocol, I should say, for when they get back to make sure that they don't bring the virus back. But folks at Intermountain say this is going to be pretty invaluable experience. You know, you can essentially study as much as you want, and it won't give you the kind of invaluable skills that you will get kind of in that frontline setting. And then they're also anticipating that these hospitals in New York, assuming things begin to die down in New York, would come and help with what's envisioned to be Utah surge kind of in the May and June window.
Return the favor, so to speak.
Yeah, exactly.
Well,
exactly.
One member of that crisis response team in New York City is Dr. R.J. Bunnell. He's an ER doctor with Intermountain Health, who is at the Long Island Jewish Medical Center this week and next, providing some of that much-needed help to the doctors there. And while he's there, he is keeping an audio journal for KCBW about his experience. This is his first entry from earlier this week, and this is soon after he had arrived in New York. Take a quick listen.
This is my audio journal, April 14th, 2020. New York City Crisis Response Team. Team was treated like conquering heroes today. Right off the bat, we had Paul and Heather, two of our senior leaders, at the security gate, wishing us well. The agents announced us and clapped. The flight crew made us the reluctant stars of our own half-empty plane. The Northwell staff, who met us at the hotel, couldn't have been warmer or more professional. Travel today was by no means normal, but it was really touching and humbling to be recognized by so many total strangers for something that we'd all volunteered for. I knew it already, but it's never been clearer to me that I work with truly exceptional people, the kind of people who run towards danger, who will knock down the door to get into the burning building. It's obvious to me the toll that this virus has taken on the community. People are tired. The streets are half empty and there's an eerie quiet outside of my hotel window. There are masks and sanitizer and people clumsily trying to keep an appropriate distance from each other everywhere. It's clear from talking to the administrators at Northwell Health that this crisis has stretched them to the limit and also brought out the best in their people. At one point in the last month, they were adding 200 beds a day. Their system is now operating with 1,000 more patients than their worst case projections. In a matter of weeks, their hospitalist service at Long Island Jewish Medical Center went from 240 patients to over 600. 85% of the patients in their entire system are COVID-19 patients. Deaths are an unfortunate, common daily occurrence, and the rapid response team and code blue calls that are used an average of 90 times a month are now happening 20 times a day. Progress is incremental. While at first only 10% of their intubated patients were surviving, now 40% are eventually able to breathe on their own and come off the ventilator. Here Comes the Sun by the Beatles is now played overhead whenever a patient is discharged alive. What a beautiful anthem of hope in such dark times. We know we're entering a hot zone tomorrow, and we can't wait.
And again, that's Dr. R.J. Bunnell, who is part of a crisis response team from Intermountain Healthcare that is in New York City to help with the COVID-19 outbreak. There, Dr. Bunnell is keeping an audio diary of his experiences for KCPW, and you can catch those here on KCPW for the next couple of weeks. We need to head to another break in the show, and when we come back, possibly a little more from this past week's news and our underplayed stories of the week. This is Behind the Headlines here on KCPW 88.3 FM and on Utah Public Radio. We'll be back in just a minute.
And you're listening to Utah Public Radio. Thanks for tuning in today for Behind the Headlines. Support comes from Utah Public Radio and Logan City Limits. The annual music festival will feature artists such as Sorry Mom, Ugly Boys, Carolee Beck, Big Sis, and more. Find the live stream today, Friday, April 17th at 7 p.m. at www.logancitylimits.com.
Utah State University President Noelle Cockett will host a virtual town hall on COVID-19 this Friday the 17th at 10 a.m. You can watch the town hall on our website, upr.org, and email your questions ahead of time to covid19@usu.edu. Again, that's this Friday morning beginning at 10 on our website, upr.org.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, and I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Tony Semerad and Robert Gerke. It's our Friday morning news roundup, heard on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. You can weigh in on what you've been hearing by calling 801-355-8255, or again, you can tweet to us. Our handle is at KCPW. We're getting close to the end of the show already, but Robert and Tony, we have a little bit more time before we turn to our final segment, just a couple of minutes before we head to our underplayed stories of the week. Gerke, is there anything in the special legislative session that's happening now that we didn't touch on that you want to circle back to at this point in the show?
One of the interesting components of this is that they put some bills on the docket. They really have nothing to do with coronavirus, including a special needs scholarship that the governor vetoed. There's one that's a railroad sales tax provision that the governor had vetoed just a few weeks ago and after the session ended. And so they've got some of that. I think another sort of nice thing that they're doing is Representative Melissa Ballard, Garf Ballard, her father, Robert Garf, died of coronavirus. He was one of, I believe, Utah's first or second fatalities from it.
Former House Speaker.
She's sponsoring a resolution honoring the first responders, medical workers, and so forth who are on the front lines. And that's, I think, something that is wholly appropriate. And I think it is going to get unanimous support from the legislature.
And this special session wraps up today, if I'm not mistaken. I guess a question that, as far as those bills go that were already once vetoed by the governor, if they pass again, will he not just veto them again?
Well, I mean, I think that remains to be seen. I talked to some folks from the governor's office, and this is interesting because if you remember, this is the first time that the legislature has used this authority to call itself into special session in an emergency circumstance. This is a constitutional amendment that was approved by voters in 2018. So it's a recent development, but it also gives them the latitude to put what they want on the agenda. The governor's office is saying that they didn't object to that. They hope that the bills are different when they pass again than that they can work out some of the bugs. It kind of remains to be seen. Right now, I mean, as we're talking here, I'm watching my Twitter feed, and they're plowing through bills in pretty rapid succession. So I think they're trying to get this done as quickly as possible. But keep in mind that this is not going to be, by any stretch of the imagination, the last time they have to come into special session. They will have to come in later and resolve some of the budget issues. I'm sure there will probably be additional workers' comp unemployment issues that they're going to have to work through. So there's a lot of stuff that they're going to have to do during the course of the year, and it's something like we've not seen before. I think even during the Great Recession, I don't think there was this urgency and sort of this comprehensive need for a response. That was an economic crisis. This is both an economic and public health crisis, and so it's going to take a lot of work for
for all part, all components of government to respond to this.
And again, historic in that it was a first almost entirely virtual session, and also historic because the legislature called itself into session, which is in normal circumstances it can't do. And this is the result of a bill from 2018 that passed. We are going to move on now to our underplayed stories of the week, our final segment in the show, and I'll bring Tony Semmerad, Tribune reporter, back in on this. Tony, what's your pick for underplayed story of the week?
Well, my underplayed story might be an underplayed story next week. Next Wednesday is the 50th anniversary of Earth Day.
Right.
I think it would otherwise be attended by some pretty significant kind of rallies and that sort of thing. It'll be interesting to see how it evolves in an age of contagion. And I just want to give a plug to UtahEarthDay.org, which will be putting on a whole bunch of kind of teleconferencing events towards the last 3 days of next week.
Okay. All right. Check that out. Tony's pick for underplayed story of the week is a pick for next week. And Robert Gierke, your choice for underplayed story.
Well, Courtney Tanner had an interesting story about, if you remember, I'm blanking on the time frame, but it was last year sometime, maybe at the end of the year before. There was this police chase that ended at this tailor shop in sort of in the Murray, South Salt Lake, Mill Creek area, I guess. And the police drove this guy into this building, shot him repeatedly. I mean, if you've seen the video, you heard the sort of staccato rapid gunfire. The owner of that tailor shop is now suing the police department for excessive force and the trauma it caused. And his, you know, the PTSD, he said, has kept him from reopening the shop. It's costing his business. He can't go back to work. He's suing the police department for $3 million, I believe it was, for you know, emotional and economic damages that were caused as a result of this. And so, you know, and if I had the same thought when I was watching the video the first time, is that, you know, he's lucky to be alive, frankly, because there were so many shots fired directly into the building. It was a fairly remarkable thing.
All right, Robert Gierke's pick for underplayed story, a story by Courtney Tanner. I want to give a shout out to Taylor Stevens and Bethany Rogers, also, who are covering this legislative session. But you can find that coverage as well at sltrib.com. I'm going to go with actually a press release from the Salt Lake County that I just got, which is not underplayed exactly. It says that 94 men in the Homeless Men's Resource Center have tested positive for COVID-19. That's out of 205 men tested. The whole center is a quarantine center now. And those who have tested positive have moved to a county isolation facility where they can monitor their symptoms, rest, and recover. That's according to this press release. But that's a pretty significant percentage, 94 out of 205 men at the Men's Homeless Resource Center testing positive for COVID-19. Anyway, Tony Semmerad and Robert Gierke with the Salt Lake Tribune, thanks very much for joining me on Behind the Headlines today.
Hey, thank you.
Yeah, thanks,
Roger. Yeah. You too. And that does it for Behind the Headlines, a co-production of KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks very much to KCPW Operations Director Jesse Ellis and to the Utah Public Radio team in Logan for their assistance on the show. Thanks this week also to Austin Booth for sound design and scoring on that audio journal entry you heard earlier. I'm Roger McDonough. Hope you were finding ways to weather all of this. And please stay safe yourselves and join us again next week.
Utah Public Radio is the modern version of the public square, where we all come together to learn the latest information about these ever-changing stories around the coronavirus. But unlike what you might hear on the street, we check the information we give so you can be sure it's true and reliable. And since you are relying on Utah Public Radio, now is a good time to support this nonprofit news source. Please join us by contributing and helping us raise $55,000 this spring online at upr.org.
Utah Public Radio is a statewide service of Utah State University and the College of Humanities and Social Sciences. KUSR Logan, KUSK Bernal, KUSL Richfield, KUST Moab, KCEU Price, KUSU FM Logan, also heard at upr.org.